A reading from the book of Exodus. When the king of Egypt was told that the Israelites had fled, the minds of Pharaoh and his officials were changed towards the people. And they said, "What have we done letting Israel leave our service?" So he had his chariot made ready and took his army with him. He took 600 picked chariots and all the other chariots of Egypt with officers over all of them. As Pharaoh drew near, the Israelites looked back, and there were the Egyptians advancing on them. In great fear, the Israelites cried out to Yahweh. They said to Moses, "Was it because there were no graves in Egypt that you have taken us away to die in the wilderness? What have you done to us, bringing us out of Egypt? Is this not the very thing we told you in Egypt? Let us alone and let us serve the Egyptians. For it would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than to die in the wilderness." But Moses said to the people, "Do not be afraid. Stand firm and see the deliverance that Yahweh will accomplish for you today. For the Egyptians whom you see today, you shall never see again. Yahweh will fight for you, and you have only to keep still." Then Moses stretched out his hand over the sea. Yahweh drove the sea back by a strong east wind all night and turned the sea into dry land, and the waters were divided. The Israelites went into the sea on dry ground, the waters forming a wall for them on their right and on their left. The Egyptians pursued and went into the sea after them, all of Pharaoh's horses, chariots, and the chariot drivers. At the morning watch, Yahweh, in the pillar of fire and cloud, looked down upon the Egyptian army and threw the Egyptian army into panic. He clogged their chariot wheels so that they turned with difficulty. The Egyptians said, "Let us flee from the Israelites, for Yahweh is fighting for them against Egypt." Then Yahweh said to Moses, "Stretch out your hand over the sea so that the water may come back upon the Egyptians, upon their chariots and chariot drivers." So Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and at dawn the sea returned to its normal depth. As the Egyptians fled before it, Yahweh tossed the Egyptians into the sea. The waters returned and covered the chariots and the chariot drivers, the entire army of Pharaoh that had followed him into the sea. Not one of them remained. But the Israelites walked on dry ground through the sea, the waters forming a wall for them on their right and on their left. Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church. The Lord be with you.
And also with you.
The Holy Gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ according to Matthew. An angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream and said, "Get up, take the child and his mother and flee to Egypt and remain there until I tell you, for Herod is about to search for the child to destroy him." Then Joseph got up, took the child and his mother by night and went to Egypt and remained there until the death of Herod. This was to fulfill what had been spoken by the Lord through the prophet, "Out of Egypt I have called my son." When Herod died, an angel of the Lord suddenly appeared in a dream to Joseph in Egypt and said, "Get up, take the child and his mother and go to the land of Israel, for those who were seeking the child's life are dead." Then Joseph got up, took the child and his mother, and went to the land of Israel. The Gospel of Christ.
The story of the Exodus is arguably the most important part of the story in the history of Israel. The second book of the Bible is the one that is most quoted anywhere else in the Bible. Out of all the cross references you come across, you'll find the Exodus is referred to again and again and again. This is the most defining moment about how Israel came to be a nation and who Israel was to be in their relationship with God. And so the story of Israel actually comes in two parts. The part that we read today from Exodus 14 with their deliverance from slavery in Egypt, and then when they arrive at Mount Sinai to receive the Torah, the Ten Commandments, the covenant of Yahweh with the people. Those two parts together make the significant story of Exodus, and you need to have both parts. Next week, we'll talk about the Torah, though. Today, we're going to focus on that first half. And another reason why we see this as being so important is that it is in the story of the Exodus that the Israelites take their first opportunity to practice their first and most significant of all the feasts they offer, that they observe every year, even to this day, and that is the Feast of Passover. It's all part of the story of Exodus. And so by way of review, how did things get to where they are today? Well, last week we looked at the story of Jacob, looking in particular at his son Joseph and what it is that he encountered that got him to a place in Egypt so that the family of Israel, numbering about 70 people, could leave the famine that was happening in Canaan and come over to Egypt, not only to survive the famine, but as it turns out, as they get to live in the very fertile area known as the land of Goshen on the Nile Delta, they are able to flourish and grow and become a great number of people, actually becoming a nation while they are in Egypt. But Joseph ends up dying. The Pharaoh he was working with passes away. Another Pharaoh comes along, maybe another one after him. The point is that at the point that we get to the story of Exodus, the Pharaoh that is now in charge has forgotten all about Joseph and everything that had gone on before. And instead, he sees with the Israelites this ready-made labor force. And so he decides to put the Israelites into slavery and use them to build a couple of cities for him. But as he recognizes how numerous they are, he decided he had to exercise some kind of population control. So he passes a law that requires any baby boy that is born to the Israelites to be drowned in the Nile River. They were to be killed. God somehow, though, well, somehow, that's the word. I'm trying to summarize things. Moses is born and is spared from that fate. And is becoming a man, and in the time that he is a man and has an encounter with God in the famous story of the burning bush. And there we are finally introduced to the name of Yahweh, the covenant name of God with Israel. And Moses is told by Yahweh to go and confront Pharaoh and tell Pharaoh that Yahweh wants his people to be freed from Egypt so that they can worship him. And so, to summarize really quickly, Moses goes out, confronts Pharaoh, and says, "Let my people go." But Pharaoh says, "No, not interested, not going to happen." And when Pharaoh does that, then a plague comes upon Egypt. Something bad happens. The first one being that the Nile River turns into blood. But not only the Nile River, any pot containing water in the homes of the Egyptians becomes blood as well. This is a pervasive thing that harms everybody in Egypt, but not those living in the land of Goshen, not the Israelites. This cycle continues a total of 10 times. Let my people go. No, something bad happens. A plague comes upon Egypt. Until the 10th one, the firstborn son of all the Egyptians is killed by a destroying angel sent by Yahweh, including the firstborn of every animal in the land as well, and of course, the firstborn son of the Pharaoh. When this happens, the Pharaoh says, "Okay, I've had enough. Go, get out of here, leave." The Israelites, having had their very first Passover meal, then exit Egypt. But it doesn't take long for Pharaoh to have second thoughts about that. And that's where we pick up the story in Exodus 14. And so now the Israelites are on their way and they come to a body of water known as the Sea of Reeds. And they turn around and they see that the armies of the Pharaoh are chasing him, his best elite chariots and everything else. And they find themselves trapped. Now, a quick little addendum here. I said Sea of Reeds. We sang Sea of Reeds. It is the Sea of Reeds where the Israelites are. Tradition tells us it's the Red Sea. We're going to sing two hymns today that invoke the Red Sea. That was a mistranslation that happened a long time ago in the Hebrew to Greek to Latin procedure, and it stuck. But the Hebrew words Yam Suf mean Sea of Reeds. So they did not cross the Red Sea. You don't have to try to picture the rabbit ears of the two gulfs of the Red Sea on either side of the Sinai Peninsula and try to figure out where in the Gulf of Aqaba it was that the Israelites crossed. It wasn't there. It's the Sea of Reeds. We don't know exactly where it is. There's some ideas. But anyway, that's all for free. The Sea of Reeds is where they are. And so they're afraid because they can't get across the water, and here we have this army chasing them. But Moses says, don't be afraid. He holds his hands out over the water, and then the water parts and stacks up like walls on the left and the right, and dry ground is there where water once was. And the Israelites are able to cross on dry ground. And when Pharaoh and his armies see what's going on, they decide to follow them. But when the Egyptians get there, it's not very dry anymore, it seems, because now their chariot wheels are all getting mired in the mud. And they start to freak out a little bit here. But once Israel is free from the water, Moses turns around, holds his hand out over the water again, and the waters close on all the armies of Pharaoh, and all of them are drowned. We sang in Exodus 15, they sank like lead in the sea. And with that, Israel is gloriously delivered by Yahweh from slavery. This story is incredible and fantastic. It is a story that is meant to evoke loyalty to Yahweh for the listeners, because remember, this story was being compiled and put together in its final form in about 1000 BCE when Israel was established as a united kingdom under a king. They're at peace, they can tell their story, and their intention in telling this part of their story is to have their listeners understand why it's a good thing to have Yahweh as your God. And so here, looking back 200 to 500 years earlier, this is what they are saying Yahweh did for them. And the idea is anything that we might have to face coming up, we can trust that Yahweh will be there fighting for us and delivering us from our enemies. And this incredible and fantastic story is told to get that point across. Now, I've called it an incredible and fantastic story twice now for an important reason. And I use those words intentionally because of what those two words mean. Incredible means that there's something about the credibility of something that is questionable. Another word for incredible is unbelievable. And fantastic means that it is the stuff of fantasy. What we've just heard described is something that is really, really, really hard to believe actually happened. I mean, twice it says in Exodus 15, the waters parted and stood up like walls on the left and on the right, and the people went through on dry ground. How does that happen? That doesn't happen. The only time walls are solid like that is if they're ice, but that's not what's happening here. So someone would say, well, wait a minute, no, we've got to believe this though, right? And we go and reach for one of God's get out of jail free cards that I talked about last week, and that's the card that says, well, God can do anything, right? And if God can do anything, then well, we should just take that all of this happened the way it did. But there's a couple of problems with that. The first one has to do with how incredible all of these events are, all the plagues in the first place, how they emerged, how this crossing of the Sea of Reeds took place. And you would think that anything that dramatic would have some evidence that it actually happened. After all, if we ever heard a story like this being told today, what would our response be? Yeah, really? You know, you crossed the Glenmore Reservoir because the water parted on either side? Like, prove it. And people have tried to prove that all of these things happened. For a couple thousand years, archaeology has been trying to see if that evidence is there. Now, people who do archaeology just simply look at the stuff in the past and find the pieces and see what's there. But there have been people who want this to be true and have deliberately gone looking for evidence for all of these things happening, and they're not finding it. Let me just suggest, too, that's a dangerous way to do your archaeology. To already decide this must be true, let's go find the evidence, because then what happens is you discard what you do to what you do find, and you're trying to move into a confirmation bias of that which you want to be true. And so there's serious question that any of these things actually happened the way that they did. The only place that records that it happened this way is the book of Exodus. That's it. But let me say what archaeology has found. Archaeology has discovered that indeed during this time, which would be the 1200 to 1500s BCE, the Egyptians did have slaves of people who lived in the region where the Israelites were and even beyond. So the idea that the family of Israel made its way to Egypt and was then enslaved by the Egyptians, totally plausible. No reason to think that didn't happen. And then archaeology has also proven that shortly thereafter, Israelites are to be found having settled in what is known as Canaan, which is where Israel is today. And so the idea that Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob had their kids, they went to Egypt, were enslaved, and then left Egypt no longer as slaves and settled in Canaan, 100%. No issue with that. that happened. The question is the nature of all of these plagues and even the crossing of the Sea of Reeds. Now, I said there were two challenges with this incredible and fantastic story. And one of them was just, could that really have happened that way? The second part is far more poignant, I think. And that is, the way that God delivered Israel from Egypt was to kill off a whole pile of Egyptians. That's what this amounts to. Yahweh is going to deliver Israel by killing Egyptians. The God that made all peoples, that the Bible had told us earlier, God put peoples where they needed to be and all this sort of stuff. God saw fit that some Egyptians needed to die in order for Israel to live. Now, picture this scenario with me. We talked, first of all, about what's going on. Pharaoh doesn't want to let the Israelites go. Pharaoh orders the firstborn children, the firstborn sons, well, actually all the sons of Israel, to be drowned in the Nile River. Pharaoh doesn't want to let the people go. So you've got Joe Egyptian over here living with his wife and kids and is trying to make life happen for him and all of this. And because Pharaoh is stubborn and doesn't want to say yes to Moses, God turns the Nile River into blood and all the water he's got stored in his water pots into blood, so they can't drink from it, they can't wash from it. It's going to attract flies and gnats and all sorts of things, which also are some of the plagues to come. And his life suffers because Yahweh is wanting to have vengeance for the Israelites because Pharaoh made the edict that Israelite baby boys had to die. The language we see in the scriptures is not even just a tit-for-tat kind of approach that God takes, but it is vengeance against not only Egypt, but the very gods of Egypt. So the conflict is Yahweh fighting the gods of Egypt, and the consequences of Yahweh in this cosmic battle is for Joe average Egyptian to suffer. Later on, there will be boils that he and his family will have all over his skin. This disease that comes upon him and his livestock. And then with the 10th plague, not only will the Pharaoh's firstborn son die, this guy's firstborn son will die too. And now you have weeping and wailing throughout Egypt as all the Egyptians are suffering the loss of their firstborn sons and the loss of the firstborn animals that make up their flocks and herds. And it's all because Yahweh is going to deliver Israel. Is that how God operates? I mean, one approach for us to take is to say, well, that's what Exodus says happened, so I guess so, that's the way God operated. At least that's the way God operated back then. Okay, if that's the approach we take, well, then we have to say that God operates differently as time goes on. Does that make sense? In the book of Malachi, at the end of the Old Testament, it says, I, the Lord, do not change. He's talking about his faithfulness to Israel, and it seems to imply that the way God operates is consistent. But does that really fit well with us? And I would suggest to you, probably not. If you take a look at Exodus chapter 15 again and look at the words that we sang this morning, the words over and over again are celebrating the fact that the Egyptian army is drowned. They sank in the water like iron. I will sing unto the Lord, for he has triumphed gloriously. The horse and rider he has thrown into the sea. Is that really how God operates? Is that really the way that God set Israel free from slavery? Here's the reason that it's a problem. This is trying to tell us something about the God that we worship, Yahweh, who Jesus called his father and encouraged us to do the same. This is apparently the God that's all part of this package. Or is it? We said before that one of the brilliant things about the Hebrew Bible is we get to see this chronicle of how the ancient Israelites describe their understanding of God. And we see through its pages how their understanding of God changes, that we can see where they got things right about God that are consistently held through all the way through the scriptures, and where there are different aspects about God that get left behind and descriptions about Yahweh that are no longer employed anymore. And this brilliance helps us to understand that we can grow in our understanding of how God operates today. Would we ever tolerate the notion that today, in order to do something beneficial for us, that God would see fit to kill off some other human beings just because they were being mean to us? I think we'd have a real struggle with that image. So I'm going to suggest to you that Israel is describing Yahweh the same way the other gods are being described. Our God fights for us, and that means he defeats the peoples of the other gods. And so that's the way it is. Nobody blinks an eye. Miriam and all the women celebrate this great deliverance. That's how the story goes. But I really question if that's the part that we should be holding on to. Now, how can I say that? Am I saying the Bible is wrong? Am I saying that it's untrue? That's an overstatement. I'm saying that this aspect of this description has been embellished for the sake of encouraging the Israelites to pay attention and to follow Yahweh. But let me say this. The reason why we can let go of the literal nature of the 10 plagues and the crossing of the Sea of Reeds is because we don't need it to be true for it to work for us. What I mean by that is when we read the Exodus account and we say, how does this speak to us? We use it 100% of the time as metaphor. Every time Exodus is invoked, it's metaphorical, especially by Christians today. And so when we talk about the slavery the Israelites experienced in Egypt and how God set them free from that captivity, and we use that as a metaphor for us, what are we talking about? Are we enslaved by anybody right now? Are we being shackled and forced to work hard for some other people group? No, we're not. But we can acknowledge captivity, and we did so in the opening collect prayer this morning. I prayed, God of love, you brought your people out of slavery with a mighty hand. Deliver us from our captivity. Well, what is our captivity? In this prayer, our captivity to self-interest and our indifference to the gifts of others. We use the Exodus as a metaphor. This happens all the time. We see it in the story of Jesus. In our gospel reading today, we are told the story of Jesus' infancy, and the writer of Matthew says that Jesus is born, and then Herod gets wind of it and is threatened by it. So Herod goes to kill off all the baby boys in Bethlehem, just like the Pharaoh went to kill off all the baby boys in Egypt. But just as Moses was spared that fate, an angel speaks to Joseph and tells Joseph to take Jesus and Mary off to Egypt, and that way they can be safe. Herod dies, the angel comes back and says, Herod's dead now, now you can come back to Israel. And then the writer of Matthew says, this was to fulfill what the prophet said, out of Egypt I have called my son. When you look up that prophet, you find out it's Hosea, and in chapter 11, verse 1, it says, when Israel was a child, I loved him, and out of Egypt I called my son. The prophet is referring to Israel as the son of God, addresses the Exodus when the prophet's actually speaking about it. The writer of Matthew uses it as a metaphor for what Jesus' experience was in the gospel according to Matthew. When we talk about what Jesus accomplished on the cross, when we talk about what took place at the crucifixion, we use the Exodus language all the time. He is the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world, thinking about the Passover lamb. Whatever it was that took place with his notion of him being sacrificed on the cross comes back to that Exodus language. But is there any image that in Jesus doing that people should die as a result? No, quite the opposite. He said, Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. Jesus taught that the God makes the sun to rise on the righteous and the wicked. Jesus said that you are not to hate your enemies. In the Hebrew Bible, you will read Yahweh saying, I hate all who do evil. And he is ready to take vengeance on those who oppose his people. But in Jesus' account, God says that we're to love our enemies, that we are to treat others the way God treats us. The challenge of taking the Exodus story, this part of it, literally, moves us into a very uncomfortable understanding of the nature of God, an understanding that unfortunately has led to all sorts of atrocious actions being done by Christians to those who are not Christians, and by Christians to other Christians who they saw to be heretics or nonconformists. The justification comes, we are on the right side, God is on our side, God is not above flooding the earth to kill people to start over again, he's not above killing Egyptians to deliver the Israelites, he's not above wiping out the Canaanites so that the Israelites can come in. Not to mention the Canaanites didn't even do anything against the Israelites when they came in, but that's another story. The thing that we have to embrace in looking at the Exodus is its importance as a metaphor for us about God's deliverance for us. So what remains then? How do we see this picture of deliverance? Well, there are different ways it's been described. We can say that we have been slaves to sin, Satan, and death, and God delivers us from that. We could see ourselves as being slaves to our own selfishness and self-centeredness. We could see ourselves being enslaved by some kind of addiction or whatever. But all of these things are spiritualized. They are not literal slavery as the Israelites were experiencing. But the image is helpful for us, that we can see that we can call out to God to bring us through these kinds of captivity that we find ourselves in, that we can choose to put ourselves into a stream of understanding that matches the divine intention of God. And in so doing, we then conduct our lives in a way that is in keeping with the way that is going to be best for us to live, and will also result in what becomes beneficial for others, which is what our collect prayer said. Deliver us from our captivity to self-interest and self-centeredness, that we may love others as you have loved us. You see, the one thing that seems to be forgotten in the Exodus story, if we just take it straight up, is that when we go back to Genesis chapter 12 and chapter 15 and chapter 17, when Abraham was first being called by God, he was given four promises, though we only list three usually. I'm going to give you a son, I'm going to make you a nation, and I am going to give you a land. But the fourth promise was, and through you all the nations of the world shall be blessed. How much was Egypt blessed by Israel? How much was Egypt blessed through this deliverance of this kind? And then when we apply this metaphor to us and we think about how it is that God is working on our behalf, how God is setting us free, is ultimately that we may be a blessing to the world. And so any reference that we make to how wonderful it is that God is on my side and God fights for me or God delivers me, whatever language you want to use, has to ultimately come down to the bottom line that we are to inherit that promise to Abraham, that we then are to be a blessing to the world. That is the bigger point of the Exodus than the idea that my God can beat up your God. We must be careful how we take these ancient writings, these 3,000-year-old writings, and figure out how we apply them to how we live today. The history of the church is rife with examples of Christians who meant well that figured we're just going to apply the principles of the Exodus to what's going on with our enemies right here, and that's justification for getting rid of them. That's what God would want. We must move away from that and embrace instead what God does for us is so that we may do for others, for their benefit, for their blessing, to see that the good news that we share is indeed good. Because look at what God is like through the actions and the words that I use to those around me, the words and actions you use to those around you. Let us embrace the story, but hold on to what it is that is consistent for today from it. Amen.